This podcast is Challenging Opinions and is presented by William Campbell.
Thank you for downloading the Challenging Opinions podcast for July 1st, 2019. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict creates a lot more discussion than agreement. One cause of that is that people often can't even agree on what they're disagreeing about. In this show, I'll talk to someone who's written a book about its coverage in the US media.
Challenging Opinions is the podcast where ideas are tested. Whether you are left or right, conservative or progressive, devout or skeptic. What matters is the strength of your argument, not the strength of your voice.
Here's what we've got coming up for you in this podcast.
Canada ought not to exist in its current form, just as the political arrangements that now exist in historic Palestine, Palestine-Israel ought
pause,
not to
pause
exist.
Pause on that for a second. That one might have flown by the listeners. It nearly flew by me. You're saying Canada ought not to exist in its current form.
I mean, absolutely, as far as the arrangements that Canada has with Indigenous people.
That's coming up in a few minutes, but first I want to thank all the Patreon donors. I appreciate everyone who contributes. In case you don't know, Patreon is basically a system that allows people to donate a buck or two per podcast or per month. That helps me to devote more time to research and to finding interesting guests. And if you think that you could do the same as those people, there's details on the website and at the end of this show. That's audio from an Egyptian news channel called Extra News. It's in Arabic, of course. That clip is 17 seconds long, and it's a news item that, in Arabic, contained 42 words. As I understand it, it was broadcast only once on Extra News, the exact same number of times it was broadcast on all the other Egyptian news channels. And with the exact same text. To the word. And every Egyptian newspaper ran the same story, 42 words long, word for word. The news was about the death of Mohamed Morsi. Morsi was the first and so far the only democratically elected president of Egypt. He won the 2012 elections after the Tahrir Square protests, part of the Arab Spring uprising that swept through the Arab world nearly a decade ago now. The Arab Spring was a protest by a mixture of people, Democrats, liberals, economic reformists and Islamists, who were against the corrupt elites that ruled, in many cases still rule, the Arab countries. The Egyptian army, the real controlling force in the country, saw the way things were going, deposed the long-time dictator, and allowed largely free elections. They didn't go to script. Morsi led the Freedom and Justice Party, an organization affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. The party weren't Islamic extremists. They confirmed that they were happy for women and Egypt's minority Christians to serve in government, but they were by no means what people who wanted Egypt to move towards the Western democratic model would have hoped for, although he did seem to be firmly against corruption. He lasted a year. The army, which controls a huge chunk of the Egyptian economy with zero oversight, staged a coup, arrested Morsi, and have imprisoned him ever since, on a whole series of charges. He was on trial last month for those charges when he died, apparently of a heart attack. This is how the Egyptian media announced his death. They all carried an identical 42-word announcement that named him and said he had died and nothing more. They didn't even refer to the fact that he had been president, much less on trial by the military. Every single news outlet waited 3 days, long after the death had been reported internationally, before they ran the story, and they all used the same text, with one exception, this clip from Extra News. Can you hear the familiar word at the end? That's right, the word is Samsung. The extra sentence that this newsreader added on the end translates as sent from a Samsung device, like the default signature on the phone of people who aren't smart enough not to make their every email into an ad for an electronics company. And like TV news stations that aren't smart enough to copy and paste the right text, they get telling them what news to broadcast. Aren't we lucky to live in a democracy where the TV news producers are smarter than that?
Do you agree? Do you disagree? If you want your point of view heard, email podcast@challengingopinions.com and say what you think.
On the line now, I have Greg Shupak. Greg has a PhD in literary studies. He teaches media studies at the University of Guelph in Toronto. He writes regularly about politics and media for outlets such as Electronic Intifada, In These Times, Jacobin, and the website Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Greg, last year you published a book called The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media. What's the main argument of your book?
The main approach that I take in the book is to essentially argue that Western news media coverage misrepresents the Palestinian question. Specifically, I do this by looking at what I see as three of the main narratives that are told about Palestine, Israel. Mm-hmm. And these are first, the notion that it is that the conflict should be understood as something in which both sides have suffered to comparable degrees, and for which both sides bear comparable responsibility. The second major narrative that I look at is the idea that this conflict should be understood in terms of extremists, so-called, having too much power. And third of all, I look at narratives that explain violence in Palestine, Israel, in terms of what media outlets see as Israel's right to defend itself. In all three cases, I essentially seek to kind of argue that instead the operative frame that we ought to apply to the situation is that of settler colonialism and resistance to it.
Okay, that may well be the case, but Israel is a country that was founded, created by the United Nations, the only country that that has happened to. Its borders are internationally recognized. Now, it occupies land outside of its borders, but leaving that aside for a moment, its borders are internationally recognized, and there isn't a shred of doubt that Israel and Israelis would have been driven into the sea and had those internationally recognized borders established by the UN entirely flouted by its neighbors if it hadn't presented a very strong defense. That is true, isn't it?
Well, no. I mean, part of what you're saying, I think, depends on what point in history we want to begin as our sort of juncture for understanding what has happened. But I would say that Israel has armistice lines. It doesn't declare its own borders, and it has armistice lines. It does not have internationally recognized borders the same as any other country.
It does have internationally recognized borders. It doesn't respect all of them, but it exists legitimately as a country. There is no question about that, is there?
There are questions about the borders.
Yes.
And where exactly these are or are not. They're also up for debate is exactly what the character of the state or perhaps states that exist between the river and the sea ought to be. As to the question that you asked subsequent to that about the 1948 war that eventually took place with Israel and some of the countries in the region, I think what you're asking me is would Israel or would all of the Jewish inhabitants of Palestine been driven into the sea? I mean, I think that the better question to ask there is what if instead of seeking to expel two-thirds of the indigenous population of Palestine in order to establish an ethno-state. What if instead they had continued the negotiations, which is what was proposed by the Arabs at the time, rather than carrying out a campaign of ethnic cleansing? Mm-hmm. So I think that we should move back the goalposts a little bit so that we're not just looking at the 1948 war as the starting point and go back quite a bit earlier.
That is possible to do, but unfortunately there's almost an infinite regression that you can take. And one point that pretty much every country in the world needs to hang on to is internationally legally recognized states, of which Israel is one. And it would not exist if it had not presented a very strong defensive posture against its neighbors. It was surrounded by enemies, and it to a certain extent is surrounded by enemies, but at its creation and shortly after its creation, it was surrounded by enemies that were very, very powerful, and in all likelihood, but for a lot of luck and a huge amount of determination, would have eliminated that legally established state.
Well, again, what I would say to that is that what's up for debate right now and since the prior to the creation of Israel, mm-hmm. is what should be the character of the state or states that exist between the river and the sea.
Sure.
And so there's no there is a kind of internal conflict between saying that, you know, Israel has the right to exist and has the right to defend itself on the one hand, and saying on the other hand, and leaving it at that without saying also, what about other elements of international law? What about, for instance, the right of Palestinians to return? What about the right of Palestinians to live as equal citizens within within what is now called Israel? What about the occupation? So I don't think that
none of those whatabouts amount to overturning the righteousness of Israel existing.
Well, what do you mean by Israel existing? Do you just mean a place
in international law? In international law, the country of Israel.
Yes. Okay. And what is meant by the country of Israel? Does it mean a place where
in its internationally recognized borders?
Okay, so what I'm trying to ask you to sort of respond to that is within the, let's say, land of all of historic Palestine, why or what is there that says, how do you reconcile what you're describing as the country of Israel as though it's just sort of not up for debate what the character that of that is or what the character of any of the political arrangements in that land is with the right of Palestinian refugees to return? So when you say Israel, do you mean that it has to be a sort of arbitrarily ethnically managed system where there has to be a Jewish majority?
No, I don't. No. What I mean is very precisely the country of Israel as recognized in international law within its borders as recognized in international law. And the reason that I pursue that is that I know that you and I as well have a huge amount of sympathy for the frequently terrible way in which Palestinians are treated, the terrible way in which Palestinians live, and a whole other series of injustices. But what I have a problem with is people rolling all of those injustices up and trying to expand them into saying that Israel doesn't have the same right to exist as other countries. And it's very easy, because the evidence is there, it's very easy to point to a huge amount of injustices committed against the Palestinians. I'm not disputing that. But pretty much every country is founded on blood. There's almost no country on earth that can be terribly proud of the truth of its foundation. Many societies, many countries have a foundation myth, but it's typically very, very different to what actually happened. And saying that Israel uniquely, because of its foundation, the way in which it was founded, has less rights than other countries just has no validity.
Well, there's a couple of points to be made there. One of which, again, returns to elements of international law are our fixations and what points in time are our fixations. But not every country, yes, it's true that many, many countries have blood-soaked foundations, certainly mm-hmm. including the
Almost
one
all.
In which I am sitting. Yes, certainly including the one in which I live. The point I'm trying to get at here is that not all countries currently are blocking millions of refugees from returning to their homes. And not all countries that are doing that are doing so because they want to engineer a demographic majority.
Mm-hmm.
Not all countries have people still alive and languishing in refugee camps as a result of their founding injustices.
Yep.
So this, you know, if you're talking about the foundation of a country or a society, foundation of a civilization thousands of years ago or many hundreds of years ago, that's a bit of a different question than if you're talking about, you know, Palestinians who still have the keys to the home from which they're expelled in 1948. So I think that that's a difference that is worth paying attention to. It's a live issue in a way in which, I don't know, the Norman conquest.
Hold on for a second. You still haven't tackled the issue, which, while I have sympathy with a huge amount of the criticisms of the government of Israel, what I have a problem with is that it is sometimes a flaw in those criticisms that it is felt that those criticisms can be wound up into questioning the existence of Israel. You could do that. You're in Canada. You could make those, say those things. And it's not many hundreds of years ago. It's 100 or 200 years ago that Canada breached treaties and causing enormous injustices with the Native Americans. In Canada,
same
in the United States, same in many. That's not unusual. It's, in fact, it's very, very common around the world. No other country seems to have that criticism, and the criticism is often made in Canada, in the US, in many other countries. We see the separation of India and Pakistan cause enormous injustices. No other country, even though people remember those histories, in no other case is that criticism used to question the existence of the country?
Well, first of all, I absolutely agree with you that the Canadian case and the American case are extremely similar and also live issues, just like the Palestine-Israel one.
Mm-hmm.
So I do, in fact, say that Canada ought not to exist in its current form, just as the political arrangements that now exist in historic Palestine-Israel ought
pause,
not to
pause
exist
on that for a second. Pause
form.
On that for a second. That one might have flown by the listeners. It nearly flew by me. You're saying Canada ought not to exist in its current form.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. As far as the arrangements that Canada has with Indigenous people, it's a unjust colonial system in which Canada has reneged on treaties and taken land from Indigenous people who never agreed to treaties in the first place.
Okay, so, almost at exactly the same time as Israel was being founded, the independent countries of India and Pakistan were being founded. And equal, if not greater, injustices were done in that. Literally tens of millions of people were thrown out of their villages and forcibly transported across borders. Typically, if people aren't familiar with the history, Hindus who were living in areas that became Pakistan were expelled. Muslims who were living in areas that became India were expelled. Nobody has ever said India ought not to exist or Pakistan ought not to exist because of that. And I think that's right. And let me editorialize a little bit here, because if you start picking at that thread, you unravel every garment in international affairs, and that's a recipe for more wars.
Well, that's not necessarily the case. You can undo political arrangements that are manifestly unjust, like not letting refugees return, or colonizing land, whether we're talking about refugees being kept from returning to their homes in historic Palestine, or whether we're talking about colonization in Canada or in Israel. I absolutely think that laws can and do change all the time. And okay. I think that that does not necessarily mean that what's going to happen is worse.
Without
consensus? Well, what do you mean consensus of from whom?
Of all sides, consensus.
Of all sides, meaning Palestinians and Israelis?
Yes.
Well, no, of course, that does not necessarily have to be the precondition, because when you have a situation of colonization and occupation, it's not necessary to say we can only stop this brutal process of keeping people dispossessed and keeping them occupied once the occupiers and those doing the dispossession agree to it, just as it wasn't saying that apartheid in South Africa should end isn't contingent upon a consensus among white South Africans per se. It should have ended
actually it was
sooner. Well, there's a variety of factors that led to it, but what the point I'm making is,
nevertheless, an overwhelming majority of white South Africans voted to end apartheid.
That's true, but my point is that the argument was valid well before many white South Africans supported it.
Absolutely. Likewise, yes.
So likewise, you know, France should have left Algeria. Britain should have gotten out of India, right? These are all, I don't think the justice of these and the necessity of these positions and the necessity of making them realities is not contingent upon the oppressors being okay with it, the colonizers being okay with it. Now, we can talk about sort of practicalities of how these things might or might not happen, but I don't think that the legitimacy of the argument is dependent upon whether there's a, you know, consensus across everybody involved, because this is not a civil war. This is a process of colonization, which is different.
Greg, when you talk about the injustices committed against the Palestinians, be it 70 years ago or today or at any point in between, I'm with you pretty much all the way. Mm-hmm. But it seems blindingly obvious that a different standard is being applied to Israel than to every other country in the world. And when you see that, I'm just very, very nervous that Israel, being overwhelmingly Jewish and certainly identified as that, it makes me very uneasy to see the one Jewish state in the world being expected to adhere to standards that nobody else is on, and the suspicion has to be that's springing from anti-Semitism.
Well, a variety of responses to that. One would be that we can take for granted that, of course, Palestinians would focus on Israel, since that's their most directly germane to their lives. But sure. Let's look then at, say, broader, call them what you want, left-wing movements, Palestine solidarity movements internationally, mm-hmm. peace groups, whatever, okay? Mm-hmm. So these, such as they exist in the West, and I'll be a little more specific to, say, Canada or the United States, those with which I've been involved and have had contacts. One, many of us work on a variety of issues. So first of all, I don't see the Israel-Palestine question as being strictly about those two parties. It is very much a matter of U.S. and Canadian policy. Hence one reason why, one extremely central reason why I'm concerned with Palestine is because I live in Canada and Canada is a major enabler of Israeli crimes. So that's point number one. It's about being responsible for what we can have an impact on. Second of all,
are you talking about supplying arms or what's? How,
I'm talking about that. In the Canadian case, I'm talking about deep economic and political and diplomatic ties and financial relations. So I think the U.S. record is well known, so you probably don't need me to elaborate on that. Mm-hmm. But what I was saying is that those of us in solidarity with the Palestinians are very, very often, I can speak to myself and cite many other people and organizations, also involved in supporting domestic social justice initiatives or stopping our governments from enabling violence or carrying it out directly in other countries. So it wouldn't be it's not the case to say that I only focus on Israel, for instance. I'm working on at the moment an article about Iran. I just published an article about Venezuela. I've written about all kinds of places around the globe.
I'm sure you have. But Greg,
that's just not me. That's not just me, though. That's true of virtually everybody, or at least the overwhelming majority of non-Palestinians who are involved in the struggle for Palestinian justice internationally. So I don't think that people are unfairly focused on Israel. I think that so people who are involved in solidarity and fighting imperialism and colonialism are taking that on quite a few fronts. It's a racial justice issue, and the people fighting against racism in Palestine are also the very same people fighting racism here, fighting for indigenous rights here and fighting for the rights of the indigenous population of Palestine.
So, Greg, can you honestly say that you don't see any element of a double standard? What I'm really worried about is that a standard does seem to be applied to Israel that isn't applied to other countries.
Well, I don't. The sort of second half to my response that I was giving a moment ago was would be to also help answer the question you just asked me, would be to say that I think that, yeah, there is a lot of special attention given to the Palestinian issue, and I think it deserves a lot of attention because this is the world's largest refugee population. The refugee question that's remained open the longest. It's the world's longest military occupation. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it does merit a certain amount of special attention. Now, having said that, I also do think that there is immense criticism leveled against all kinds of other injustices around the world. And I just cited many, several instances moments ago. So look at people who are opposing U.S. Machinations against Venezuela or Iran. Okay. There's mm-hmm. a lot of, can we say that the U.S. is being unfairly singled out? I don't think so. And when, as I was suggesting before, criticism of Israel is not just criticism of Israel. It's criticism of its enablers, U.S., Canada, EU, etc. Is there not criticism of Saudi Arabia that you see? Is there not criticism, which again functions, is also functionally criticism of U.S., Canada, etc.? This is about a system of global imperialism and capitalism. It's not about just Israel. Israel's one of many ugly manifestations of that. And as to the anti-Semitism question, or that you think underlies this, or that you're concerned may underlie some of this, I mean, I would just refer you to the literally uncountable number of pro-Palestinian Jewish organizations that are out there. So go read Jewish Voice for Peace's explanation as to why they're anti-Zionism.
Yeah, I don't dispute that there are many, many people who could in no way be described as anti-Semitic, who are fighting for the rights of Palestinians and for justice on that. That doesn't mean that there are also some people. I'm not accusing you of that. Let's just turn the focus to how that conflict is presented in the Western media, which I think is the main focus of your book. And yes, you have criticisms of that. What would be your main criticism on that?
Well, it's hard to give a sort of sweeping statement about media in general, because of course there's a spectrum of different media out there that approach this from different angles. But if I'm to keep, as I do in my book, to somewhat more what are called typically liberal publications, New York Times, Washington Post, that type of thing, sometimes The Guardian, I'd say the two main recurring problems I have, if I may say two, would be with what I called reducing what the violence that happens in Palestine, Israel, to being a problem for which both sides are guilty to a comparable extent, and as a result of which both sides have endured comparable amounts of pain. I see that as an extremely prevalent and misleading trope in the media. Likewise, this recourse to frame what takes place there in terms of Israel enacting what commentators call its right to defend itself.
Okay, so first of all, I think I'd agree with you. I don't think there's any real argument that it's simply not true that the position of the average Israeli or the typical Israeli is in any way nearly as miserable as the position of the average Palestinian. There is an enormous difference there. I'm sure there are many people who are not aware of that, but that's perhaps, you know, there's a lot of things people are not aware of. Is there, are you saying that there's some deliberate misrepresentation?
You know, deliberate is a tricky word. I think that the nature of the news media system in let's say the Western world, I'm not as familiar with media systems elsewhere, so I'll keep to what I know. But I think it's the distortion is the consequence of the way that the system works. I don't think that people are sitting around hatching plots to try to dupe the population. I think that misrepresentation on this and many other issues is a consequence of the way the media functions as an institution.
For example?
I think that you're probably familiar with the book Manufacturing Consent by Chomsky and Herman. I think their theses are basically correct. So, for example, I think that the fact that these media outlets are big businesses in their own right encourages them to adopt effectively pro-status quo, pro-business, pro-commercial positions. And the influence of advertisers in the sort of profit-making quest of news media outlets is another major factor that leads to the distortion that we see on a whole host of subjects, as do the various social linkages that exist between not necessarily or not only journalists, but certainly editors, certainly the people who are on the boards of directors of media outlets, who very much are enmeshed in their social relations with the other kind of elements of the ruling class.
Hold up. Are you sure that you're not just expressing your frustration that your opinion is not the only one represented? Everybody thinks the media is biased against them. Why do you think you're special on that?
Well, it's not about me or my opinions. I have avenues to get to express my opinion, so I'm in a better position, I think, than a fortunate position, I should say. No, it's true that everybody or many, many people perceive the media as misleading, including, you know, people on the far right who think the media is, you know, left wing or that or something like that. Why do I think my analysis is correct? I would say I think it's correct based on the research that I've done. And people are free to obviously read what I've written about it or look at the sources that I cite and conclude differently. But that's how I've arrived at the position. I have studied the issue, and these are the conclusions I've drawn.
Give me an elevator pitch. Can you give me one sharp example?
One sharp example of what? Media misrepresentation?
Yes.
Okay, so let's say you know, the New York Times during 2014, Israel's carrying out Operation Protective Edge in Gaza. And the New York Times says innocent civilians are suffering on both sides. Well, I think that's a misrepresentation because it's conflating, as you acknowledged, the situation in which people on the Israeli side of the Green Line are living versus that of people in Gaza. That's one quick example. If you want others, we can point to outright falsehoods like the recent instance of media outlets reporting that that the Venezuelan government burned aid trucks without evidence, when in fact the evidence, as became clear, indicated that it was not them.
Greg Shupak, PhD in Literary Studies and author of The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel and the Media, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thanks for having me.
Never miss a show. You can subscribe to the podcast for free using iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or any other podcast software or app. See challengingopinions.com/subscribe for details.
Go to the website for sources and links to what we were talking about. And while you're there, please like the show on Facebook, follow at ChallengingO on Twitter, and follow Greg Shupak at Greg Shupak. And get in touch with me if you can suggest a guest or a topic for a future show. Also, thanks to everyone who signed up as patrons on Patreon so far. I really appreciate that. It means I can devote more time to research and to finding interesting guests. And if you could do the same as them and donate a buck or two per podcast or per month, you will find the link on the website. You can also go there to find out how to subscribe to the podcast for free on your computer, on your phone, or by email. It's all at www.challengingopinions.com. The Challenging Opinions podcast is produced and presented by me, William Campbell. Thank you for listening.